when Susan Podobretsky and I talked about this service, and she offered this wonderful poem that Jan just read, we were talking about how things become other things. A jagged rock becomes a smooth rock, and then a pebble, and eventually a grain of sand, she said it more poetically. An acorn becomes a seedling, and eventually a tree, right? That bears more acorns, and a bud becomes a flower, and eventually a fruit. An egg and sperm become a baby, which grows and becomes many, many things over the course of its life and eventually dies and becomes something else again. So the area that I've been staying in looks a lot like the Driftless area just west of Madison. It's full of these steep hillsides with these narrow little valleys in between them, and then wider valleys around the larger creeks and the river that flow all year. The hillsides here have sandstone at the very highest elevations, and way, way back in time, that highest elevation was all connected. It was one big plateau that was made over 500,000 years ago. This whole place where I am now was part of an inland sea back then. And various rock layers were made over a course of about 250 million years by the layering of sand and silt and clay, bits of shells and skeletons and plants dropping out of that sea onto the bottom and then becoming compressed and solidified. And so the top, that top layer of sandstone, was the hardest and the most compressed. And so now climbing up the hills here is kind of like traveling through the processes that made this valley. The sandstone caps on the top, they're the bits that remain of that original plateau, and they look like these tall cliffs towering over the rest of the hillsides. The hillsides come up and then whoop, there's this sandstone top. The slopes that I get to climb to get to those caps, they're made of layers of limestone and shale that were laid down one over the other over the other, over those 250 million years. And they lie beneath the plants and the soil that I'm climbing on. And those layers, those are softer than the sandstone, and they erode way more easily. They've been scoured for centuries, worn away by water flowing over the top and making these little depressions in the sandstone landscape to start with, and then gathering in those depressions and wearing these little rivulets down into it, deepening and deepening those worn places until at some point that water reaches those softer layers. And then really doing the work of erosion there, wearing through parts of the smooth stone and turning the plateau into a series of valleys eventually. In that process, making stones and pebbles and sand and silt out of all the different kinds of rocks as it wears them down and carrying them along to make the bed of the stream that's been created that I talked about last week, right? Walking along and picking up rocks. That stream bed also changes over time, because the levels of the creek rise and fall with rain. There's also springs and seeps in the hillsides, places where the water has found a way to move between the layers that still exist. So erosion happens from the inside too. So today, there's a series of creeks flowing through each of these little valleys, fed by groundwater moving through the rock and surface water when it rains. The creeks eventually meet, both way up in each little valley or holler, right? There's lots of little branches to those creeks. And then from the different hollers, one by one, they consolidate their flow eventually into the Kentucky River. The creek beds are full of all kinds and shapes and sizes of rocks, chunks of that hard sandstone that have broken from the top, still with ragged edges. Lots and lots of smaller stones and pebbles that have been eroded and shaped by the water, and lots of silt from the most erodible rock layers. The littlest stones and the silt are carried the furthest through the holler and out into the broader floodplains of the streams and the river where people farm, right? Because of all that rich soil that comes down from the creeks. So there's this beautiful valley of diverse landforms and life forms that has taken hundreds of millions of years to become what it is now and is still in the process of becoming. Because of the incessant flow of water and the nature of the rock beneath it. Another way of looking at that process is to say, to become the valley it is today, it had to unbecome a sea, and then it had to unbecome a plateau through forces outside of it and within it, just like us. To become the person I am today, I had to grow and learn and gather and connect. I had to depend on others, right? All the outside forces. I had to support others, share with others, navigate relationships. I had to love and be loved, hold and be held, trust and be trusted. My own becoming has been made up of so many experiences that have offered me something to take in from the outside and integrate it to create a new version of myself. But of course, that's not possible without accompanying losses, losses of other versions of myself. I had to lose what my childhood connection, my childhood rejections fostered. I had to lose the angst and the rebellion that helped me navigate my teen years. I had to lose the insecurity and the need for validation in my 20s. I had to lose the exceptionalism that characterized my 30s and the I'm always right. I had to lose the blind devotion of my 40s. This process has felt like Susan's poem, like the natural becoming of something beautiful every day. And along with these things and many others that felt like part of a gradual evolution of my being, I've also lost things suddenly, sometimes ready and willing, and sometimes not, in choices made by me or by others. Death and loss of my dad, of other people dear and near to me, was an unbecoming of who I was in those relationships, right? When those people go away, that little piece of me that related to those people in that very special way also went away. Or at least slipped back down underneath the surface. It's an unbecoming of who I was in those relationships and a journey of becoming someone different. Becoming a mom was huge, and it meant losing or at least putting aside for a while parts of myself that relied on freedom and, yes, control. Becoming a minister required unbecoming of self-orientation. Unbecoming a wife through an unwarranted divorce required intentional rediscovery of my own passions and desires, and really of my own self. I remember talking with my therapist at some point during the first year of that experience and saying I felt silly discovering myself in my mid-50s. Didn't I already know who I was? She replied that I'm discovering who I am now. And most recently, I've unbecome a woman of childbearing years, and I'm still waiting to see what I'll become next. But here's the thing. Those sandstone caps, those remnants of the bottom of that sea, they're still up there. The layers of limestone and shale, they still exist under the soil. And the pieces of those different kinds of rock that are carried and bounced down the hillsides and shaped by the water flowing over them are still pieces of limestone and sandstone and shale. Even the silt that becomes just plain old sticky mud when the water hits it is made of the same elements that it was when it was stone. Throughout all of the changes, all of the stages, all of the gains and the losses, the learnings, the steps of unbecoming and becoming, there is an essence that remains. that candle holder that Carol broke was still pieces of that candle holder, and the action of breaking them and turning them into something new encapsulated for her that sense of sadness that came with the piece and allowed her to turn it into something new. We're a combination of that essence and the way we're shaped by our experiences. The Black science fiction writer Octavia Butler, author of so many deeply insightful books, often set in dystopian futures, wrote in her seminal book, Words You Have Heard From Me Before, from Parable of the Sower, all that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change. God is change. I've preached before on how this idea represents process theology, the understanding that God and we are in this continual process of co-creation with and of one another. Today, I'm thinking about how that process requires each of us to be continually learning and experiencing new ways of being, breaking things to make new things, and how the inevitable and necessary casting away of some of those old ways or reshaping of some of those old ways is part of that journey, that co-creation. This is a deeply personal journey, even though it can be a shared one. And like many other journeys we take in our individual lives, there's a version of it that's happening in our collective life as well. Yeah, thank you, Jan. Denial is the first stage of grief. We've been in so much grief this past year as we've been forced to unbecome people reliant on in-person interaction, on touch and intimacy and simple human contact. We've had to change a lot of our behaviors and practice to reflect a growing awareness of how interconnected we truly are to keep a deadly virus from spreading among us. We've lost jobs, security, lives, cohesiveness, peace, trust, all in the span of a year. Even those of us who haven't been personally impacted by the virus are feeling the effects of prolonged isolation and fear in our mental and physical health. And I think we're moving out of denial. The national uprisings and shift in demographics to include more Black, Indigenous, and people of color as elected officials after last summer's murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery showed a raising of our collective consciousness and a movement. Could it be that we're finally unbecoming a society that can ignore or even justify such violence? Could it be that we are smashing that candle holder? The pandemic has made it far harder to continue to deny the disparities in healthcare, in support, in employment, education, and policing between white folks and our Black and brown siblings. And more of us are talking about it, electing people who are more focused on doing something about it. I finally got a chance to attend the Justified Anger's Black History course that they teach every year, because it was offered online for the first time. 500 people took that course this year, as opposed to the usual 100 or so. And in our own lives and journeys, when we can actually embrace the understanding that unbecoming is part of the process of becoming, that we have to lose pieces that have been part of who we are, that we might still be really attached to, then we stop being in denial. Collectively, I think one of the things we can take from this time is the realization that our grief at all of this unbecoming is already past denial, and into the rest of the stages of grief that happen before we move to an upward turn. Pain and guilt, anger and bargaining, and depression have been rampant among individuals and communities and our nation. Those of us who are ready, who have been prepared for this time, or who have been preparing for this time by surviving and embracing the unbecoming in our own journeys, those folks can begin to think about the final stages of grief, the reconstruction, the acceptance, the hope, to create the tipping point Reverend Williams says is the beginning of a culture shift. And so I think in this time of unbecoming that we didn't ask for and in so many ways is incredibly painful and difficult to navigate, it's also time to begin to ask what we've lost that we want and need to leave behind. What needs to unbecome? Because the possibilities of what we might become are beautiful every day. May it be so. May we be so.